You are listening to AfterSight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Thank you for joining us for the New York Times Magazine. My name is Bill McCann. Today is Sunday, April 14th, 2024. And I'm going to start with a letter of recommendation and then see what else might be interesting. In defense of never learning how to cook, I hated domesticity so much that for years I lived happily without a kitchen. This $19 device helped me survive. It's a story by Iva Dixit, the staff editor for the magazine. I found it while walking through the home goods section of TJ Maxx, the American retail equivalent of the Garden of Earthly Delights, at 8 on a Tuesday night in 2015. It was 2 days after Easter, and in this Hieronymus Bosch land of shopping anarchy, the shelves were stocked with pastel-colored objects of uncertain usefulness. Sacks of fruity, medley popcorn dyed green and purple, a giant tub of millennial pink Himalayan crystal salt. Somewhere among these novelties, I spotted a carelessly abandoned gadget calling itself the Dash Rapid Egg Cooker. The cashier rang me up, didn't share my enthusiasm for the cheery cockiness of its packaging, which proclaimed that it perfectly cooked 6 eggs at a time. Baffled, she asked me a question, the answer to which would have embarrassed anyone but me. Don't you know how to boil water? No, I didn't. And at 22, not only did I not know how to boil water, I didn't even know how to turn on a stove. Now, these may both seem like gaps in knowledge that could have been easily rectified with a 60-second trip to the kitchen, but you see, I didn't have one. Earlier that day, I had finally moved into my first solo apartment, the garden-level basement of a Manhattan brownstone that was rented to me by an absentee owner, which, in lieu of a real kitchen, came outfitted with a mini-fridge, a hot plate, and a microwave. That evening, after a long day of unpacking, I sat down on the building's stoop, ate my way through a bag of discounted Cadbury mini-eggs. After 20 minutes spent wallowing in disbelief at where life had deposited me, broke into a series of earthquake-sized sobs. But it wasn't misery making me dry heave. It was relief. 2013, I fled my old life for New York, the promised land for stunted young adults evading responsibility. I'd spent my childhood, teenhood, and earliest adulthood consumed with daydreams of an imaginary future in which I lived alone, my only ambition in life. In these painstakingly detailed fantasies, the greatest luxury I could imagine was having my space and my empty hours all belong to me and me only. In these visions, there was no one snatching storybooks, the beloved Indian parent euphemism, even if you read adult fiction, from my hands and barking at me to get up and make tea whenever guests came to visit, or grating at me to bring out hot rotis straight from the stove and put them onto the plates of fathers and uncles. The milieu I was raised in tried to drill into me the idea that keeping a home and the domestic labor it entails, the cooking, the serving, the dusting, the wiping, were acts of profound nobility, that they were crucial to the formation of the only life I was predestined for, one that came prepackaged with a husband and children, two species, I had been warned, that were equally incapable of feeding themselves and whose supervision would fall to me. In rebellion, I refused to learn even a single tenet of good housekeeping. If I remained useless in the kitchen and egregiously incompetent at household chores, then I could at least retain some control over my life. And no amount of yelling, berating, or shaming from my parents, elders, or concerned strangers could sway me from this zealotry. At no point during this teenage mutiny, however, had I considered what I would do if these prolonged daydreams were ever granted. It escaped me that actually living alone as an adult involves being in possession of some basic skills I had avoided acquiring. Yes, now I was finally king of my kitchenless fief. But what was I going to eat? Cinnamon Toast Crunch and rubbery takeout every day for eternity? That night I paid the skeptical cashier $19 for the spaceship-shaped device and took it home, feeling the first cracks of doubt emerging in my lifelong belligerence toward domesticity. The Dash Rapid Ed Cooker is exactly what the name declares, a device that has precisely one purpose. It cooks eggs rapidly. In the rare case of realities matching up with an advertising slogan, they are indeed perfect. I followed the instructions, starting by placing just one egg and pouring in the few centimeters of water it needed to cook. Through some magic of steam and electrical engineering, the Dash magically conjured an egg of ideal consistency in less time than it took me to brush my teeth, wash my face, and apply my acne cream. I did thankfully have a bathroom. As French chefs and inept bachelors of various nationalities can attest, mastering a perfect egg is the gateway to mastering a cuisine altogether. A good egg is breakfast, lunch, dinner, and all snacks in between. A good egg is the foundation of bigger cooking ambitions, now that you have mastered the trickiest basic of them all. A good egg is the start of complete self-sufficiency, because it's a meal and an accompaniment all in itself. On that April night 9 years ago, giddy and drunk on my own invincibility, I ate the first thing I had ever cooked by myself, for myself, a half-boiled egg, sliced neatly in half on top of plain supermarket white bread that I had lathered with cold scraps of salted butter and thin slivers of red onion. Till then, mine was a life that often felt cobbled together from accidents and gambles. That immaculate half-boiled egg, with its semi-liquefied insides roiling on my tongue, was the first thing I felt I'd actually earned on my own. I still didn't know how to boil water. I had a job that paid me the queenly sum of $30,000 per year, yet it was still more money than I'd ever conceived of. More important, I finally had the only thing I ever really wanted, my independence, my time. Eva Dixit has previously written about the joys of eating raw onions, the evergreen popularity of Sean Paul, and why Oppenheimer is for the girlies. Now I'll read the Screenland section. Want to see this film? Movie studios won't let you. As in the case of Coyote versus Acme, sometimes an entertainment company sees more value in not selling you its products. Story by T.M. Brown. In early February, strange news appeared about Warner Brothers Discovery's plans for one of its films, a live-action with animation spin on Looney Tunes called Coyote versus Acme. The studio didn't plan to release the film. It had tried to sell it to a third party. One industry report said Netflix, Amazon, and Paramount were all interested, but no deal ever materialized. Audiences seemed unlikely to ever see the thing. All this, industry watchers agreed, was not about cinematic merit. It was about accounting. Warner spent about $70 million making the film and might have gradually recouped that amount the usual way by releasing the movie to paying audiences in theaters and on streaming platforms. But it might instead shelve the movie, interring it in a metaphorical graveyard and writing it off as a total immediate loss rather than absorbing that loss over quarters to come. One report estimated this might net some $35 million to $40 million in tax savings, though a Warner spokesman described the scenario as inaccurate, adding that no final decision has been made. Studios have been doing this sort of arithmetic a lot lately. Over the last few years, Warner, which also owns channels like TNT and TBS and streaming platforms like Max, has whittled down its content and development holdings in an effort to reduce costs and chip away at its $45 billion gross debt. Near-complete movies have been mothballed, underperforming shows pulled from streaming libraries. Disney Plus, Hulu, and Paramount Plus have made similar decisions, roiling an already baffling patchwork of streaming options. You can now watch an HBO property like Westworld on Amazon Prime Video, but not through the network that made it in the first place. The purgatory of Coyote versus Acme galvanized audiences in an interesting way. Unlike other high-profile cancellations, say the 2022 film Batgirl, axed during post-production and called not releasable by the head of the Warner-owned DC Studios, Coyote was a completed film. It was also, by all accounts, good. Will Fort, one of its stars, called it incredible. This wasn't the movie's first funeral, either. News of its cancellation was first reported on November 9th, followed later that day by an anonymous member of the movie's production team posting a behind-the-scenes reel of the crew's work on YouTube. The video was taken down after a copyright claim, but it had already revealed some of the ingenious mayhem that audiences would miss out on. Squished cars, real clouds of dust kicked up by an animated roadrunner, charming prop renderings of the cartoon's rocket skates, and hand-painted signs. Say what you will about the artistic value of a film based on a cartoon, but this movie looked fun. The backlash to Warner's reported decision might have helped prompt executives to try selling Coyote on the open market. February report in The Wrap suggested that Warner rebuffed other studios after they failed to meet the asking price, said to be even higher than the studio's own production costs. The Warner spokesperson says no formal bid was made by any of the distributors who viewed the film for possible acquisition. Another theory floated to me by someone who worked on the movie was that executives were concerned about embarrassment if Coyote turned out to be a hit for someone else. Either way, it felt as though the only parts of the film most people would see were promotional stills shared by Eric Bauza, a voice actor who worked on the film. The movie was based on a 1990 New Yorker piece by the humorist Ian Fraser, which had Coyote filing a lawsuit over the indignities he had endured at the hands of Acme's unreliable explosives and physics-defying spring shoes. In one image, Fort sits next to his cartoon client, who wears a familiar dopey expression as he endures this legal showdown with his mail-order tormentors. You can picture the hijinks. In fact, a small army of designers, animators, and demolition experts spent years imagining them. Those people want their work to be seen. A sizable audience wants to pay money to see it. Yet that mutuality isn't enough. Millions of dollars and thousands of hours went into creating something that could simply vanish into accounting. Art has always been commerce, and studios like Warner have long controlled the media were offered. For almost a century, they have scrapped projects and let ideas languish, mostly without ever knowing much about it. We might complain today about pop culture governed by algorithms and data, but it's not as though 20th century decisions about which movies hit Blockbuster or which songs dominated the radio were based on some high-minded meritocracy. We've always been at the mercy of boardrooms. What's changed is our awareness of how such things work. There was a time when only the subscribers of Hollywood trade magazines knew much about which movies were in development, to say nothing of which were canned. But audiences today are as intimately acquainted with upcoming projects as they are with the financial maneuvering behind them. This isn't just a matter of more of us reading entertainment news. Normal people have been forced to attend to this stuff, baroque tangles of licensing and distribution rights, just to be consumers. Feel like streaming a favorite sitcom? You'll need to know which subscription matches that media, and then keep up with whatever agreements, disputes, or mergers will dictate its availability or shift it into another company's library. Even ownership of media has become an intricate concept. You might purchase a movie from a platform like Amazon Prime Video or Apple TV Plus, but you're still subject to the vagaries of the deal. Things may simply disappear from your digital library because of expiring agreements. The mechanics have been laid bare, and it's consumers who have been burdened with navigating them. It's particularly maddening that this visibility doesn't translate to malleability. No matter how well you know the ecosystem, you remain under the thumb of corporate arrangements. One parent I know described a child's panic when beloved songs or videos would vanish from wherever they previously accessed them. It's not easy to explain digital rights management and international licensing to a five-year-old, and yet it's precisely those complexities that might dictate whether or not they can watch Co-Camelon on vacation. Consider, too, the barrage of marketing campaigns intended to monopolize our attention through every stage of a film's development, from conception to release. Marvel Studios has its phases announcement, in which it outlines years of planned movies and shows in splashy events designed to keep fans in a frenzy about the long-term strategy of a major media company, as though a shareholder meeting has broken down at Comic-Con. As much as a satirical legal filing written from the perspective of a cartoon coyote's lawyer can speak to the moment, there's a section toward the end of Fraser's story that maps out a bit of the Daffy labyrinth consumers now face. Quote, as the court is no doubt aware, defendant has a virtual monopoly of manufacture and sale of goods required by Mr. Coyote's work, Fraser wrote. The coyote has come to distrust the defendant's products, but had no other domestic source of supply to which to turn. This is one impact of media consolidation. Studios can work very hard to hold your attention before deciding, at the last possible moment, that they're better off throwing out our artist's work than letting you pay money to see it. Coyote versus Acme, the Warner spokesperson said, remains available for acquisition. Remains available for acquisition, just not by you. Now I'll read a featured story. How Kurangbin's sound became the new mood music. Texan trio vibes have spawned countless imitators, but their magic isn't easy to replicate. I'll spell that. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing it right. It's K-H-R-U-A-N, Kurangbin, A-N-G-B-I-N. K-H-R-U-A-N-G-B-I-N. This is a story by Ryan Bradley. I worry that the word vibes is overused, but in what follows, it's unavoidable. The band Gurengbin, a trio from Houston, has become so popular that there now exists an entire subgenre of music broadly known as Gurengbin vibes. If you had walked into a relatively hip coffee shop in a major or even minor city lately, you would have probably encountered Gurengbin's vibes. They're marked by low-key, reverb-heavy, often guitar-forward instrumentals. Music that's groovy and pleasant, bewitchingly exotic yet comfortingly familiar, inoffensive and instantly graspable as existing within a particular sonic space. A vibe, as it were. That such music has become to have a real toehold on the culture says as much about the way the music is listened to today as the sound itself. Music now exists primarily within the stream, which is to say, passively. We turn it on like a faucet and our outpour songs representing some mood or emotion or any of the other words we used before we had vibes. Perhaps it's an aura like chill or a vague, evocative mindset like Always Sunday. The tap turns and outpour songs we already liked, along with burbles of what it is, a little new and different, yet fits in beautifully. This is the arrangement in which Gurengbin vibes excel. Such music is extremely slippery, genre-wise. Is it psychedelic lounge dub? Desert surf rock? The sound you hear inside a lava lamp? As such, it pairs well with a huge span of music across genres and eras. It has a kind of algorithmic inevitability to it. But this slipperiness also means that quite a lot of the bands now producing Gurengbin vibesy music are entirely forgettable. Fortunately, being the three musicians who popularized a sound that so many others are chasing is not the same thing as chasing that sound yourself. To the members of Gurengbin, pronounced Gurengbin, finally, Gurengbin, and featuring Laura Lee Okoa on bass, Donald Johnson on drums, and Mark Spear on guitar, that sound is not so much a goal as a result. It's what happens when they play music together. And while many others have tried, and are still trying, to identify and replicate what's so particular about Gurengbin music sound, this is not really possible, because what happens among people when they play music together cannot really be quantified. Often, when it works, it's more, well, it's more vibey than that. Steve Christensen, Gurengbin's longtime producer, explained it to me like this. Just about every day, he gets hit up on Instagram by folks asking how to achieve a particular Gurengbin sound. He responds, keeping no secrets, readily giving away everything, because Okoa, Johnson, and Spear have used pretty much the exact same setup for well over a decade now. Their gear and their instruments are simple, straightforward, to the point of being borderline ascetic. Okoa, for example, has not changed the strings on her bass since 2010, when the group first formed. When people write back to Christensen, which they often do, they will tell him that they now have all the same gear and have learned all the songs perfectly and still cannot quite get the same sound. Well, I'm sorry, he tells them, but that's just how they play. Someone might copy Spears' rig down to the last knob setting and play his guitar melodies note for note, but without Ochoa and Johnson playing too, the Gurengbin sound cannot be duplicated. I know it sounds simple, Christian says, but it's, if they're not playing as a trio, it just doesn't sound like KB. Questlove, the producer and documentary filmmaker, author, and longtime band leader of The Roots, is someone who has thought quite a bit about this quality in music, the ineffable alchemy that can occur when certain musicians join together. When he first saw Krangbin, he was grabbed by not just the way they played, but also by their extreme level of togetherness. They are so well gelled, is how he described it. This quality, he went on, was a very rare thing, particularly in a trio. Think of the Police, he said. Like, it's so hard to do that. Musically speaking, you have to check your ego at the door and just trust that someone completely gets you. And the Police were plagued enough by bickering to disband after about 8 years. Krangbin has so far been together for about 14. After he first saw Krangbin perform, Questlove reached out to the group. He was enamored with their sound, he told me, and wanted to find a way to help them preserve it. They have magic. I don't want them to ever lose that. You know what I mean? I had to admit that while I sort of understood, I had also never been a member of a wildly popular band. How did one lose the magic? That was easy, Questlove said, by not checking your ego, by having one person stand like, oh, look at me, look at me. This was especially difficult to avoid, he said, because musicianship, like so much else these days, was increasingly focused on the individual. So how did Krangbin gel so well and stay so well gelled? Spear and Johnson first met in 2004 when the Houston keyboard hero Cleo Sample was toured with Daniel, pointed Spear out to Johnson saying, that white boy, he's amazing. Both musicians were giggling heavily in Houston. Both musicians were gigging heavily in Houston. Johnson played in funk and jazz combos when he wasn't playing organ in church, while Spear played with just about anyone from ska, hip-hop, and rockabilly to Zydeco and R&B. He was, Johnson says, like a Swiss Army utility knife that can do it all. Spear often felt as if he were the only guy in town moving among all these different scenes, and he took pride in trying to make musical connections among them. He played guitar with Solange Knowles back when she was performing as solo star, and remembers asking, Solo, have you listened to Flaming Lips? Around 2006, Spear and Johnson began playing together at St. John's Downtown Church. Its pastor at the time was Rudy Rasmus, whose love of jazz and exacting ear had long made the place a sort of Everest for local musicians. Beyonce grew up singing there. Johnson put it to me simply, Rudy knew if you sucked, and if you sucked, you didn't get hired. Johnson grew up with gospel, but Spear was also a wonder at it. It is, Johnson says, a type of music that is all-encompassing, containing many genres at once. It also requires kind of egoless playing. You have to be listening intensely to the other musicians and to on-the-fly changes from the musical director, who is locked in on the pastor who is responding to the congregation. After rehearsal on Tuesday nights, the two of them would get tacos and beers at a nearby bar. One bartender had an iPod with a lot of good, obscure music from around the world, all of which Spears seemed to know about already, tracing scales and techniques from one continent to the other. He's like a musical encyclopedia, Johnson says. In fact, Spear told me that one of the most formative musical moments in his life came when he discovered a Microsoft Encarta CD-ROM included with his parents' new compact and became obsessed with its huge catalog of 30-second music samples from all corners of the globe. One of Sears' friends, Okoa, eventually joined the Tuesday night drinks. She wasn't a musician. She was studying art history and would later teach math to third graders. Soon after meeting Spears, she noticed him playing his guitar along to any song that came on the radio. One day she asked him, "How do you do that?" He told her it was just a matter of following the bass, which led her to try playing one herself. "It was the first time an instrument just felt easy," she says. Spear didn't so much teach as guide her. He would hear me playing and would come over every so often and be like, "Is that where that note ends?" Years passed. Spear asked her to join him on a short tour backing the electronic artist Yappa, who was opening for the British DJ and producer Bonobo. It wasn't just playing on stage that gave Ochoa the confidence to think about starting a band of her own. It was backstage watching Bonobo's camp, where she saw what music making required from like a go-getter organizational producer type place. Everything around the music suddenly snapped into focus. "I love spreadsheets," she explains, and seeing firsthand that musical success also required those skills made being in a band feel like an attainable goal. She and Spear had been playing together in an old barn Spear's family had in Burton, about 90 minutes drive west of Houston, in the wide open hill country. Now she asked Johnson to join them to start their own project. His ultra-tight, nearly metronomic hip-hop drumming was an ideal thread for Okoa's mellow, melodic bass to fold itself around, all while Spears' guitar sang its gorgeous, worldly melodies over the top. The magic, Ochoa said, was there from the jump, but she also knew, even after a few gigs around Houston, that they needed to get out on the road to really grow. To do that, they needed recordings. Out at the barn, over 18 hours or so, they cut about 14 tracks. One of them, "A Calf Born in Winter," begins with the distant sound of jingling bells, maybe sleigh bells, maybe something like the bells from Javanese gamelan music, followed by a pretty little line from what sounds like some kind of zither. Then Spear and Ochoa and Johnson made their musical entrance. The song has no chorus, no hook, no bridge, no vocals. It meanders along its own absorbing path. Ochoa eventually got the track into the hands of Bonobo, who used it on his 2013 contribution to Late Night Tales, a beloved series of mixtapes built on nocturnal moods. Why Bonobo's mix included far better known artists like Nina Simone and Bill Evans. The Kerrangman track was the standout. Here was a band no one had heard of with an exotic name, Thai for engine fly, or less literally, airplane, and a sound that felt timeless and impossible to place, with seemingly no other tracks by them available anywhere else. It was easy to imagine the recording might have come from some long-forgotten 1970s Thai psychedelic rock outfit, the kind of crate digger find so popular among music nerds. That it turned out to be a trio from Houston only made them more intriguing. Over the next 2 years, more tracks from that initial barn session trickled out. The three toured and toured as their audience grew and grew. They put out a full album and another and a very good disc of dub remixes. They sold out Red Rocks in Colorado, the Greek Theaters in Berkeley, and Los Angeles, and two nights at Radio City Music Hall. They made two EPs with a fellow Texan, Leon Bridges, one of which, Texas Sun, made it to the top of Billboard's Americana Folk Albums chart. There was also an album with Vieux Farka Touré, son of the Malian guitar god Ali Farka Touré. They recently remixed the Paul McCartney song Pretty Boys after he tapped them for his McCartney 3 Reimagined project. What is most notable, listening to their collaborations, is that the essential Krangbenness of their sound is impossible to dispel. Even the more famous collaborators get gathered into the band's sonic world. This is what has led the trio to dominate this niche in the streaming environment as the flagship purveyor of alluring, mood-setting music that will mellow out the air in your home or boutique or TikTok video. Unlike with so many forgettable imitators, their particularities somehow refuse to stay in the background. They draw in and hold your attention. To date, Krangbenz's albums have passed 775 million streams, a large number that still doesn't capture their weirdly broad appeal. Their frequent festival shows come closer. The audience for those tend to be a remarkable cross-sections of scenes. The EDM kids and hip-hop heads rubbing shoulders with the psych rock freaks. If the algorithms have a habit of slipping cramming tracks into everyone's ears, it's surely because that works. They beguile across tastes. The three of them like to joke that if they had any sense of how big they would one day be, they would have picked a name that was easier to pronounce. But even the name is added to the band's intrigue and iconography. Same goes for the wigs Spear and Ochoa have always worn when photographed on stage. A spur-of-the-moment choice, Ochoa, right before Krangbenz's first show. I'll be honest, it was the look and the name that grabbed me first, David Byrne said in an email. He had recently gone with Ochoa to see the singer-songwriter Mitski perform and was struck by how anonymous Ochoa was when out in the world wig-free. He, like Questlove, was a big Krangbenz fan and thought of the band as existing within a genre he called instrumental pop, which he then defined with a glorious set of musicians, the Serbian guitar virtuoso Branko Matija, banjo player Ustad Nur Bakish, the Ethiopian jazz legend Malatu Astaki, and Santo and Johnny, best known for their 1959 steel guitar hit Sleepwalk. These artists come from wildly different scenes, different eras, different continents, and yet to the modern listener, all are similarly marked by an easy beauty, a genrelessness, a vibe. Last month, I met with Ochoa, Johnson & Spear in Brooklyn, where Ochoa now lives. They were in town to rehearse tracks from their new album, A La Sala, for a new tour, their 19th. Much of their progression as a band has involved adding new layers to the stripped-down, airy sonic space they found in that barn. From vocals, sung by all three at once, though always mixed, so Spears' guitar melodies remain the focus, to the percussive, danceable sound of their last studio album, Mordechai, from 2020. A La Sala, however, goes in the other direction. It's quieter, less busy, more like a return to the band's earliest days in the barn in Burton. Even though it was not recorded in the barn and is, in fact, the first time they've made one of their own albums outside the barn. This was a purely practical decision. When they got together to record, Choa was 8 months pregnant, Being out in the middle of nowhere seemed like an unnecessary risk. Instead, they used Steve Christensen's Houston studio, which is in an old warehouse. Brick walls, concrete floors, train tracks nearby, a sheet metal roof that got loud when it rained. All three members of Drangbin become animated when talking about sound, the space around each tone, how to fill the right gaps without letting the music get crowded. But Spear in particular is particularly obsessive. Between sessions for A La Sala, he would travel out to the barn with a field recorder and tape things like hand claps echoing around the space. These types of recordings can be used to create what's called an impulse response, a model of the way the space reflects sound, which could then be used in the studio to make the music they were playing in the warehouse sound more open, more barn-like, more like Guangbin. Once, out in Burton, Spear was noodling around on a little synth and composed Les Petits Gris, a stripped-down track that closes the album. Throughout the recording, there's ambient noise, crickets, birdsong, creaking wood, the musicians' hushed breaths. Feels like a direct rebuke to the idea that a band's getting bigger and more successful has to mean getting busier, louder, and more danceable. The three now live apart, Ochoa in Brooklyn, Spear in a tiny town north of San Francisco, and Johnson in Houston. In Brooklyn, together for the first time in months, conversation turned to the upcoming tour. Spear said he wanted to spend it getting back to basics and becoming a better player. Johnson laughed. "I can't believe Mark," Spear said, "I want to be a better player." When they started, Ochoa and Spear explained everything around them. All the different scenes of their Houston lives contributed to their sound, but success in touring had pulled them from the environment that shaped them, something that didn't help the music, because it was not what had given them their peculiar vibe. What had? Spear described a wine bar in a town near his where a group of local musicians played. He'd been eyeing it up, hoping to sit in on congas. It was this sort of exploration, being in different scenes, finding new things to try, that he wanted to return to. Johnson, when he's home, still plays organ in his grandfather's church. Ochoa tried to explain what Spear was driving at, what he meant by getting back to basics, by telling the story of a bad show they'd had at a huge venue. She had been pushing Spear on being bold, being bigger, but he was struggling with his pedal board. It was driving him bananas. Why did his guitar suddenly sound different? This was all the same gear he'd always used, the same stuff he'd used since the band began. Where was the magic gone? Turned out that the stage was so big that the signal from his guitar was degrading as it ran through the very long cable required to cross it. It's tempting to read this as a metaphor for success, but it was also the answer to the question of what made Kuringbing. Theirs was a sound of self-imposed limits, not just of three of them playing, but also of the spaces between, the sounds of the barn, its birds and its crickets, the length of the guitar cable, a sense of distance, but never too much. Ryan Bradley is a writer based in Los Angeles. He last wrote for the magazine about the Lorraine song, Find It. This is a follow-up from an earlier story from a week ago on deathbed visions. Readers share stories of their loved ones' deathbed visions, rich, deeply personal stories of visions and the peace they have brought to people's lives. When I started reporting when deathbed visions teach us about living, about the visions often of loved ones that some people have in their final stretches of life, I had no idea just how universal the experience was. But within minutes of the story's publication, readers took to the comments section to post their own memories of having witnessed the phenomenon. The stories were rich, deeply personal, and seemed to confirm something that the researchers featured in my story. Dr. Chris Kerr knew in his years of studying such visions, they bring peace to the dying and solace to the living. Family members wrote in with stories of watching loved ones have visions, as did healthcare workers who had years of experience witnessing them. I was especially moved by readers diagnosed with terminal illnesses who wrote in to say they had found comfort in the comments section and could now face the days ahead with less fear. As readers' reactions suggest, these visions and their meaning are often open to interpretation. Some readers saw evidence of an afterlife. Others see them more as vivid memories conjured from within. Until my own mother's death, I'd never witnessed an end-of-life vision or thought much about them. One afternoon, as she was talking about her latest vision, my mother remarked, "I wonder if other people have this experience." As a regular reader of the New York Times, she would have been delighted to find the answer in the comments section from readers like herself. Here's one from Mark Ferguson, computer programmer, Austin, Texas. "As my grandfather lay in his bed, close to the end of his long life, he had a vision and pointed to the far wall. 'What are you seeing?' my grandmother asked. 'A transcendent view of the queen,' he replied. 'Which queen?' 'The queen of all the world,' he answered reverently. 'Is it your mother?' He nodded and smiled and fell back asleep." Mary Thurston, historian and author from Austin, Texas. "Toward the end of my father's long life, he kept telling me he was seeing a little dog sitting in a chair next to his bed. He described the dog in detail and would point his finger at it with serious certainty. After he died, going through a very old and dusty box of his things, I found a sketch he had done as a child of his little pet dog sitting in a chair. I put it on the cover of the card for his memorial service." Gloria Metz, retired hospice nurse. "I'm a retired hospice nurse, having worked in the field since the 80s. I can recall many stories like those commented on here. My favorite was a male patient in his 60s who had been a smoker most of his life and was dying of lung cancer. One day I walked into his room. To my surprise, he was making lunging motions up in the bed. I asked him what he was doing. He said he was climbing the stairs to heaven. I helped him lean forward as carefully as I could to help him safely make the motions. About an hour later, he died. We can support the dying best by believing them." Karen Stein, marketing manager at a college. "My mom passed away in 2023 after gradually declining from Alzheimer's, vascular dementia, and myelodysplastic syndrome for a couple of years. But a month or two before she passed away, she started talking about how she needed to get the suitcase down from her closet because she had a train to catch. And just a couple of days before she died, when she had been barely conscious for maybe a week, all of a sudden, she opened her eyes, looked at a fixed point in front of her, and said, 'Hi, Dad.' Clear as day, in a calm, confident, hopeful voice. Then she closed her eyes and went back to sleep as if nothing had happened. Her father had passed away about 20 years earlier and clearly came to guide her, as he had done in life. I feel so grateful to have been present with her to see that sacred moment." Jane French, caregiver. "At the end of his life, My dad was blind. Arthritis fused his cervical spine, forcing his head downward. He lost the ability to walk. His kidneys and heart fought each other. He became unresponsive. A week before he died, I paused in the doorway before entering his room to find him engaged in a lively monologue. I touched his arm. He announced, "Everyone, I'd like you to meet my daughter." I straightened and waved to the empty room. He spoke and looked around with ease. He sat relaxed, crossing and uncrossing his legs, conversing with his children and long-gone co-workers. As he spoke, he made grand gestures. I audibly gasped when he lifted his spindly arms over his head and looked toward the sky while making a point. His movements resembled a man decades younger than 91. After a while, he grew tired and fell back asleep. I will never forget how the mind can overpower the body with such ease. Keith Walters, retired college professor. Throughout the 90s, I volunteered at a 5-bed residential AIDS hospice that accepted all who needed care. I spent time with many people, most young, many older, living with the knowledge that they would soon die. All the staff and volunteers had stories of residents announcing that they needed to pack for a train or bus that was coming, or that they had been visited by people we could not see, but who had been an important part of their lives. With rare exception, these were narratives characterized by a sense of peace and acceptance. We learned to read them as signals that death was near, and it always was. Like Sarah Teasdale contemplating the stars, I know I'm honored to bear witness to their stories. Melina Fiore, nonprofit executive. My mother was a German Holocaust survivor, and even though her father was Jewish, hers had not been a practicing family. She had a religious experience right before she married my father. He was in the U.S. Army Special Forces. That was how they met, and became a practicing Catholic. She had a stroke a few months before her death and was partially paralyzed. While lying in her hospice bed weeks before her death, she told me that all her relatives were there in her room and began to have conversations with them in German, sometimes laughing, sometimes weeping. She requested a visit from a rabbi and became more and more peaceful in her final days. Moments before her death, she opened her eyes and looked up. She started to sit up, and with a face that I can only describe as illuminated, she said, "Oh, the love. Oh, the love." Thank you for joining us for the New York Times Magazine. My name is Bill McCann.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303-786-7777.